Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Peter Brummel. I'm the editor of VDare.com, and I'm coming from it to you from the conference room of the Berkeley Springs Castle in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, which is VDare's headquarters, and it's where we hold our conferences. We bought this castle, as some of you will know, because the regime won't allow us to hold conferences in public spaces, in corporate hotels. We have something like 12 canceled in the 2 or 3 years after Trump was elected. So we decided to buy our own conference venue and refurbish it, and then that's where we are now. Now, the conference, our next conference is April 26th to 28th. I'm happy to say it is sold out, but you can buy live stream tickets still by going to VDare/donate, and I believe the details will be flashed up by our video audio video expert at some point when you're looking at this. Now, what are the speakers? We have a number of interesting speakers, in fact, a lot of interesting speakers at this conference, but one of them is with me tonight, and this is Steve Saylor. As you will see, I'm coming to you from the conference room, and Steve Saylor is coming to you, as he always says, from his closet. Well, now you can actually see the closet in Studio City, I believe, in Los Angeles. But he's not in his pajamas, which he usually says he is. Why can he figure out the world sitting there in his pajamas and people don't? He knows why Finland does so well in education, is because it's full of Finns, and massive educational bureaucracies and foundations can't figure it out. Now, every once in a while, Steve does come out of his pajamas and actually emerges into the real world. About 11 years ago, he spoke for us at a conference in Boston for VDare. And last year, he spoke for us. He gave the keynote address, I guess, at the VDare conference last year, which was an enormous success and got a huge viewership. So I'm very happy to say he's going to be speaking for us next Saturday night. How are you, Steve?
Well, I'm real good, Peter, and I'm looking forward to my second visit to the Brimelow's fortified compound in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. My speech last year at the summer conference from VDare was, as far as I can recall, my first public speaking opportunity since I gave a speech in 2013, as Peter was mentioning, in a Boston hotel meeting room over the 2012 exit poll results. It didn't strike me as terribly inflammatory, me going through a whole lot of numbers about the appeal of Romney and Obama to different groups and places. But then for the next decade or so, it was practically impossible for me to get booked anywhere to speak without, when word went out that like Steve Saylor and some other thought criminals like him were speaking, that, you know, threats would be made against the hotel, of bad publicity, of potential violence, and the venues would cancel out. So I was pretty much on the shelf as a public speaker for about a decade here in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
That's what I say to that. Well, we're very happy to have you, Steve. And you're the kind of thought criminal for whom we had in mind when we bought this castle.
Thank you very much.
We intend to go on hosting thought criminals here. We're very lucky in that Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, is a very supportive community. The Trump carried Morgan County by 52 points. And it's actually a really interesting example of what we call the Saylor, what I insist on calling the Saylor strategy, which is your insight in the speech you gave in Boston, which is that the target of opportunity was the white working class, whereas Karl Rove thought, of course, we want to go whoring after the minority vote for inscrutable reasons. West Virginia, as you know, and you pointed this out many times, is part of the Scotch-Irish belt, which quietly migrated to the Republicans right across the board. I mean, in 1980, it was a rock-hard Democratic state. Carter beat Reagan here. now it's a rock hard Republican state, although it's very poor, I'm sorry to say. Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts on, you know, did the sailor strategy prove the winning path for Trump in 2016? This general strategy I first wrote about in VDare in at the very late 2000, almost 24 years ago. I mean, no, I doubt that the Trump Brain Trust read my old article and said, oh, well, this is obviously the one true path. But it kind of was the one possible path they had to victory. And then when you look at the Electoral College, when you look at the exit polls and so forth, you know, it's the only one that really made sense for them. And so they came up with it themselves, I'm sure, and, you know, eked out a narrow but remarkable victory. Does it work in the 2020s with the great replacement carrying on, bringing in ever more diverse voters, allowing the Democrats to build an ever larger coalition of the fringes that tries to stay together by kind of demonizing the Republicans' coalition of the core of Americans? You know, we'll see. I mean, the Democrats' long-term strategy, building what they'd call a coalition of the margins in America, of the marginalized, makes a lot of sense under current immigration policies and under social trends that emphasize minoritarianism, emphasize victimhood, emphasize people redefining themselves as, well, I'm not a regular American. I'm this new identity that was just created recently. The Biden administration just this year announced, for example, we've created an entire new race. No longer are just anybody with some roots in the Middle East or North Africa, they're not condemned to be white anymore. They get to engage in flight from white to join their own brand new race, Middle Easterners and North Africans. So Republicans haven't really yet kind of figured out the basic dynamics of what's going on, but there's starting to catch on that the game is kind of rigged. So it's going to be hard to see. The great replacement's real. It's more of a displacement. It's more of a great dilution of people's votes, bringing in all sorts of new ringers decade after decade. And the Democrats' strategy makes a lot of sense, except the Democrats got to keep their coalition of the fringes from becoming a circular firing squad and turning on each other, keep the welfare mothers and the transgenders and the movie moguls and the Hispanic day laborers and everybody, and just this mob of people who don't have much in common.
You wrote a piece for us, and I think it's more than 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
It must be more than 10 years ago, in which you said, the Republicans should politely point out and concede the fact that the Democrats are the black party, because basically nobody wants to be in a party with blacks, as it turns out. The antagonism between the various parts of the coalition, the fringes, is very intense.
Yeah,
it's crossed my mind that actually, I mean, obviously the spectacle of the BLM riots in 2020 actually is one reason why there's some sign that Hispanics are migrating away from the Democratic control, though not for the reasons that Karl Rove thought they would.
Yeah, I wrote this in 2008 or 2009. The Republicans haven't caught on quite yet, but the Democrats kind of follow out the logic that, the highest moral priority per capita in the Democrats' coalition of the fringes rests with blacks. And maybe with transgenders, there's a constant struggle to be at the top of the pyramid of victimology. We've seen lesbians get pushed down the ladder. Hispanics were fashionable a number of 10 years ago and are pretty far down in the Democrats' priority list. So from starting in 2014 with Ferguson and Black Lives Matter movements triumphs, and you started to see, the Democrats putting Black issues, what they perceived as Black issues, like Black should be more or less above the law, the cops shouldn't arrest Blacks just for engaging in criminal activities. Blacks should be allowed to drive real fast down the street and not get pulled over. If they get pulled over, they should, they shouldn't be checked for outstanding warrants, and they definitely shouldn't be searched for illegal handguns. And then and that turned out to be kind of a disaster, which led to the various Black Lives Matter terrorist attacks on the police that killed, a dozen or two policemen over a few years in the mid-2010s, and helped get Trump elected. But then during the complete mania of 2020, the Democrats and the establishment in general, academia, the media, et cetera, announced the racial reckoning. I didn't make that term up. It was used constantly by the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, et cetera, to explain that what whites should be subjected to good and hard during 2020 and 2021. And, it was a complete catastrophe with probably something like 500 violent riots of looting and arson that went on practically to the election. I can recall Joe Biden kind of finally in late October 2020 putting the word out, like, okay, this riot in the streets of Philadelphia, we really need to carry Pennsylvania, and this is bad. So finally knock it off with these mostly peaceful protest people. But it took poor Joe like the entire summer into deep into October to realize this was kind of a losing thing. So Black bad behavior that was enormously indulged by the Democrats and the Democrats Party, which I call the establishment or the elites or basically the possessors of institutional power in the United States, that basically alienated some of the other members of the groups. The Hispanics look at it and went, they're just letting Blacks get away with everything. Is this really what we want? And some other groups, the gay shopkeepers the Jewish deli owners on Fairfax Boulevard on West Hollywood, the gay shopkeepers on Melrose Boulevard, were these mostly peaceful protests in which their establishments got smashed up? Did that make them that enthusiastic about the Democrats? We've seen some evidence that the coalition of the fringes of the Democrats is developing some cracks.
The New York Times, had a much-touted Siena poll that came out a couple of days ago. They were very excited about it because it showed that Biden had drawn to within a point of Trump. But what strikes me about it is if you look at it in more detail, what you find is Trump's share of the white vote is not all that exceptional, actually. I think he gets like 53 or 54% of the Y vote, which is not as awful as George Herbert Walker Bush got when he lost. But he's nowhere near what he should be. It wouldn't be at all reasonable to see it over 60%. There are various ways of interpreting this. One of them is that the Trump people have not, in fact, made a concerted effort to appeal to whites in a very explicit way, and that was certainly clear in 2020 when they had the Platinum Plan and all this nonsense, and did not, in fact, go in and shoot up Minneapolis and crush it, declare an insurrection and crush the riots. Other way of looking at it is that, there's a sort of Damocles here hanging over the Democrats' head. Because it may well be that the whites will just quietly decide they're fed up with this. Maybe they're not turning the polls to that. There's a lot of room to grow with the Saylor strategy, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, the issues are, is it possible to bring together, to find Republican candidates in the future who combine the best aspects of Trump and the best aspects of, say, Mitt Romney, and put those to work in terms of a sort of coherent plan. The thing with Trump is he's got good instincts about, what's actually pretty good for America. And they're not super original. It was just kind of the basic wisdom of somebody who grew up from the 50s into the 80s. And, says, let's not have, enormous immigration of just everybody who wants to show up. Let's try to do something about our industrial base to protect it and keep good paying jobs in the United States. These are not, this is just kind of the basic conventional wisdom of, probably Nelson Rockefeller in 1964 or something like that. But on the other hand, Trump drives a lot of people crazy. And, some of it's Trump's fault. I'm not going to pass it up. So is it possible in future elections, after we get this, after we have this election this year, where the average age of the candidates will be around 80 years old, at some point there's going to be a future, and hopefully younger generations are going to come forward. I'm younger than Trump, and I'm definitely younger than Biden, but I can feel myself like, I'm not as much in my prime as I was 10 years ago. So hopefully there's a new generations out there that can kind of square this circle for the Republicans and take Trump's good ideas and continue to appeal, but to the working class, but not alienate as much of the more striving upper middle class in the suburbs. But we shall see.
Just to back up a second, one of the most remarkable things you've done recently is your discovery that not only has murder increased dramatically among the black community, but so has traffic deaths.
Yeah.
I think Charles Murray said that it was one of the most beautiful social science insights he's seen for many years. So I have a two-part question. One, has that been picked up at all by academe, or they're just not going to look at this kind of thing?
It's the two sides of it have been picked up. All right. In 2004, at the end of 2014, a police chief in the St. Louis area started talking. Just a second here. No, is that all the way off camera? Good. Started talking about a Ferguson effect, that there was that murder rates had gone up in the St. Louis area ever since the Black Lives Matter emerged during the Ferguson riots of August 2014 and the Obama Justice Department declared that they were going to dig in and find the racism in the Ferguson Police Department, which eventually they admitted they couldn't find any. But you know, the cops all over St. Louis got the message that, like, don't pull over so many people, don't give tickets, don't search for guns. And what happened? People started carrying guns more, illegal ones, that they'd go to jail if they were searched. And so they'd take, you know, rather than leave the gun, you know, in their grandmother's, hidden away in the grandma's attic, they started packing it in their waistbands when they went to a party. And then if they ended an argument with somebody else at the party, maybe they just couldn't take it anymore, they'd pull a gun out, start shooting. They'd probably miss the guy they were shooting at, but, you know, wing a couple of people standing around in the background eating ribs. You know, so you just had this big increase in shooting all over St. Louis. You also, at the same time, had a big increase in traffic fatalities. What's going on? It's basically the cops aren't pulling over bad drivers and calling them in for warrants and patting them down to see if they got a gun. So people start driving worse and carrying guns and shooting each other, and also crashing into pedestrians and driving.
Has there been any academic notice? There's a huge academic industry in this country. Has there been any academic notice of this taken? Why is it up to you to point this out?
Nobody seems to have connected the traffic. There's been a lot of academic notice lately that traffic accidents shot upwards in 2015-16 and somewhat stabilized, then just went through the roof in 2020-2021. And then there's another set of academics who look, but that's usually done by people who are pushing traffic infrastructure construction, that we need more roundabouts and we have to totally and bike lanes, and they have, you know, a whole agenda involving making America's roads look more like the Netherlands roads. And they tend to get real offended when you go, oh, well, no, you know what? The reason there's pedestrian deaths and traffic deaths in general are way up in the United States since 2014 compared to almost the rest of the world, where they keep going down, is, yeah, it's partly for some of your reasons, but it's not like the infrastructure got worse in the United States when suddenly traffic deaths went up 20%. It's because the cops stopped enforcing it during the Ferguson era and then the Floyd era. And you can see it right here, you know. So the Ferguson era goes from, you can see it as, you know, first happening in St. Louis, and then in Baltimore, the Freddie Gray riots. And it almost happened in New York City, but basically the NYPD mutinied against the liberal mayor and their police chief, Bill Braddon, went, yeah, you guys, carry on. You don't have to do what the mayor says. And so the mayor backed down, and New Yorkers stopped shooting each other all of a sudden. But in other places like Chicago, the Justice Department, the ACLU came in and completely destroyed, Chicago's law and order. So you could see all of this evidence of the Ferguson effect, and you could see that it was happening. So the criminologists were noticing it. Eventually, the leading criminologist went around and said, well, okay, yeah, we said there's no such thing as a Ferguson effect. Finally, guys like Richard Rosenfeld came around and said, yeah, there is a Ferguson effect for homicides. And other academics went, yeah, you know, people are getting run over very much. And I started going, yeah, and especially they're getting run over more and shooting each other more in Ferguson. You know, I found a big article in St. Louis newspaper about how the main drag in Ferguson ever since 2014 has had a huge number of traffic fatalities. Who could have guessed it? Well, then it was all forgotten about. Then in 2020, shootings just went up instantly. By the weekend after George Floyd's death, Chicago had its all-time record 24 hours of murders. You know, this is the storied history of Chicago. People shooting each other, going back to St. Valentine's Day massacre and some like it hot, And by 2021, I was pointing out, it also started in June 2020, is a huge increase in car crashes, especially among Blacks. And it's just gotten much worse. And so what we're seeing is kind of the flip side of what the economists, Angus Deaton and his wife, Ann Cates, called the rise in deaths of despair among the white working class from 2000 to 2015. And that actually caught on, and that's a major discovery. So what I discovered by 2021 is kind of what you can call the growth of deaths of exuberance, when people drive faster and they take their illegal handgun to a block party. And, they get in arguments with people, and then they start blasting away, like at the Super Bowl victory party in Kansas City, stuff like that. And so we've had
the thing about the shootings, of course, is that they do primarily affect other Blacks. But the car, traffic accidents, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
Because they're hitting cars, they don't know who's in them. I mean, so I presume there's been some increase in white traffic fatalities as well.
Yes, everybody's up.
But what we don't know is whether those traffic fatalities are caused by bad Black driving, but it could be.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you can see the Black traffic fatalities shooting up about 25% by about the second or third week of June 2020. The homicides went up the first weekend after George Floyd, because that kind of appeals to a particular class of people who bring their guns to parties and stuff like that, and are very sensitive to, hey, the cops are busy, trying to keep mobs from burning down Magnificent Mile in Chicago. So I'll just go to this party where those guys that I don't really get along with are going, I'll just take my gun. And then bam, 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 18 people murdered May 31st, 2020 in the city of Chicago.
Well, you lived, of course, for a long time.
Yeah, I lived there for a long time. So
my wife, yeah. Steve, one of the things that struck me about watching your work is that you tend to get interested in things from time to time. And you've obviously got an interest in this death and exuberance issue. I guess your book, which we're going to talk about in a minute, it does really hit on things that are most interested to you. I mean, what was it, looking back on it, what are you most proud of? I mean, the death of Zoom is a great discovery, but at the same time, you turned around the Charlottesville, Heyman Monahan fraternity, Rolling Stone thing. That was you who did that, wasn't it?
I was the second pundit that jumped in on it, and I promoted heavily Richard Bradley's skepticism.
This was the story that some girl claimed she'd been raped in a white frat house.
The origin is that after Obama was reelected in 2012, something then immediately started happening in 2013 that I had vaguely predicted in my book about Obama in 2008. I said, I think Obama's views on race and social issues, his policies during his first term, are going to be pretty moderate, because he doesn't want to alienate whites. But that's going to be frustrating to the people who work for him, who are true believers in kind of the evilness of, whiteness and the vileness and so forth and so on. So come 2013, the Obama administration started doing all sorts of things, like sending out this Dear Colleague letter to colleges about how we've got way too much rape on campus by, you know, fraternities and lacrosse teams and basically the whole Democratic list of bogeymen that, you know, straight white men, and they're the enemy and they must be crushed. And this got a huge write-up in the New York Times, and the New York Times is constantly promoting it. And there was just more and more hysteria in the prestige press over rape on campus and in the military, and just basically aimed at humiliating, crushing kind of any organization that, such as fraternities that foster white male leadership. And so the peak came in late 2014 when Rolling Stone ran this giant article about that asserted on this one young lady's say-so that she had been gang raped by seven fraternity pledges as part of a annual fraternity ritual initiation ceremony. And it was all, she was gang raped on top of broken glass for 3 hours. And so I pointed out, on top of broken glass, really? Are you sure that, I mean, what about the rapist fraternity boy's hands and knees? Aren't that getting, what about a one part of them that they only have one of, and they're probably even more sensitive about? I don't think I really believe this story. And then at that point, you know, the floodgates opened up, and yeah, it was totally ridiculous. It was just a co-ed making up stories that were eventually, they're sort of, you know, slightly pornographic rape fantasies by this young co-ed based on a lot of her favorite TV shows like Dawson's Creek and so forth. And, you know, she, but it led to an actual Kristallnacht on the University of Virginia campus, where leftist groups came and smashed the windows of fraternities across campus. And eventually, you know, Rolling Stone magazine lost a bunch of lawsuits and had to pay a lot of money to people that they'd slandered with this utterly 100% fabricated story about Haven Monahan's, you know, misdeeds and so forth. So, yeah, that was a good example of what happens when the Democrats' coalition of the fringes gets carried away in kind of the underlying racist, sexist hate for straight white men is indulged too much. And, you know, slowly over the last decade, the public's kind of coming to notice that, yeah, you know, the Biden administration, I mean, you know, indulges, they've got a lot of people working for them, have these kind of feelings, and are kind of out to get people who they see as core Americans, or they're kind of remind them demographically of George Washington or Benjamin Franklin or John Adams, and they're just the enemy, right? We need to hate them. We need to be all aligned hating them. But
Steve, you've actually been out of your pajamas an unusual amount this year because you've been on the road promoting your new book, Noticing. Perhaps you could brandish it.
Yes. Here is the beautiful hardcover version. They printed up 395 copies. It's leather bound. It's they printed up 500 copies. They charged, and I always laugh at the exorbitant price of $395, but they've sold almost all the 500 so far, and I haven't got any complaints from people. It's kind of like, well, there are people out there who really, who really want to have this beautiful book. It's kind of like from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, these fragments I have shored against my rune. And if you're not interested in, if you're not a book collector for beautiful books, but if you like to read, here's the paperback version that's out now. It's a not unreasonable $29.95. It's also, people are telling me as they get it in the mail, slowly coming in, that's beautiful paperback. So it's a 468-page anthology of a lot of my best stuff.
I believe we're advertising this, so I have links to it on the site right now.
Yeah, just search for Passage Publishing Noticing Paperback Sailor.
As I say, I think there are links on the site on Vita
yeah.
right now.
Okay,
as you say, we did publish for you your book on Obama.
Yeah.
Half-Blood Prince, America's Half-Blood Prince. It was in the very early days of internet publishing, and we were sort of experimenting with it.
Yeah, well, in 2008.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, in 2008.
Right. We'll have copies of The Castle for people who are here,
yeah.
So that you can sign. But this current thing is not that was original work,
yes.
Half-Blood Prince. Well, this is really a collection of Sailor's greatest hits, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I'm not going to promise it's all the greatest, partly because, you know, that I wouldn't mind doing a volume two of the almost greatest stuff. But I went through and we looked real hard for the for kind of the more landmark stuff, you know, the Sailor Strategy one from V-Dare in 2000. My article in the American Conservative in 2000, in beginning of 2003, explaining, you know, this upcoming Iraq attack, this Bush's invasion of Iraq, you're not going to be able to nation build and turn Iraq into a country like Switzerland, I mean, a country like Japan or Germany. And here's one reason that nobody in America has ever thought about. People in Iraq love to marry their cousins, and so the whole society is not a broad society of citizens. It's a whole bunch of clans who are closely related to each other, not just by blood and marriage and both, because all these first cousins marry each other, and they all hate each other. And they're just going to go to war with each other for power, and it's going to be a nightmare. And yeah, that's exactly what happened. And the U.S. got itself into just a disaster in Iraq.
I think one of your most successful catchphrases has been invite the world, invade the world, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because you do see that even in Norway publications now.
Yeah. If we invade all these countries, then... And then it turns out that, oh, we can't fix them up the way we fixed up Japan and Germany. And that after World War II, by the 1950s, not that many people in Japan or Germany wanted to immigrate to the United States because they could see a future for their country. And, you know, things worked out pretty well. In Iraq, in Afghanistan. Afghanistan makes Iraq like Switzerland in a lot of ways. Is there any kind of path? And it's like, no. It's an inbreeding Iron Age culture. And these people aren't going to see themselves as like, oh, well, I've got a future superb Afghanistan of the 21st century, they're going to go, no, I got to get the hell out of here to Lewiston, Maine, or somewhere like that.
Which is ironic, though, if you've seen pictures of Afghanistan in the 1950s, it was quite remarkable. I mean, women wore veils, and they had clean streets, and it's remarkable.
Yeah.
Compared to
then kind of the basics of Afghan culture kind of took over once again. No help to the no help from the Soviet Union or the United States in terms of invading the world. And so we ended up inviting the world in. So, and the kind of thing we do, our foreign policy usually then leads to us taking in more and more refugees and more people showing up, claiming to have some sort of, you know, asylum right and so forth. We end up with our State Department people in Mexico and in the Guadalumbias of Central America, like reading the rules very carefully and then explaining to all sorts of people there that, oh, you don't have to be an illegal alien. You can be an asylum seeker. Here's all the rules you have to follow. You just show up at the border. And so, you know, the establishment in America has just been encouraging, you know, this huge influx from Central America. And now it's like the word of it is spreading around the world to like Africa, the last place with a really fast growing population boom. So we're starting to build all sorts of African communities across the United States that can then be magnets for their cousins, you know, to the Mauritanian community of Cleveland or wherever. It's just a disaster for the country. And, you know, voters seem this year to be kind of annoyed by it and blaming the Biden, blaming the Democrats, blaming the media, as well they should. Will they keep that in mind through November? Or the press is going to do everything in its power to downplay the borders, just as they're doing everything in their power right now to downplay this enormous crime surge that the liberal establishment sponsored, that's gotten tens of thousands of incremental Americans killed in shootings and in car crashes since George Floyd's death and the Declaration of the Racial Reckoning. So we'll see.
Of course, it's much more difficult to find this now at internet searches, isn't it? Google has become so much more politically correct now. In terms of, we can see this in our own traffic data. It's extremely difficult to find out what's going on.
Yeah, it used to be that one third of my traffic data was just walk-ins from Google and the other search engines every day. Now it's basically a good way. It's a good way if you're a Steve Saylor fan. You can still, you know, to get the if you put my whole name within quotes and specify a website like BDAIR or TalkieMag, you can typically eventually get Google to tell you where, you know, my article from 2003 prophesying all of this stuff is hidden away. But, you know, it doesn't attract that many readers. The good news is that once Elon Musk made a bid for Twitter, Twitter took its boot off my throat, and I'm now up to like 121,000 followers on Twitter and growing steadily. And, that's a really good site.
There's still obviously some shadow banning on.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is that VDAIR, is still suffering what I was suffering until Musk came along. Right. So my stuff, you know, you guys send out blog posts of mine, and they get 37 thumbs up. And it's not bad, but, you know, that was what I was getting for decades now. You know,
but the other thing is that they still are knocking people off all the time.
Yeah,
for some inscrutable reason they just banned your talking mic colleague David Cole.
Yeah,
and here in West Virginia,
they, never let Jared back on?
Never let Jared Taylor back on. We have a gentleman,
Jared Taylor.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's totally genteel. It's almost as genteel as you are. We have a primary candidate in the Southern District of West Virginia, Derek Evans, who was a J6er, and is running against incumbent Rhino. And they suddenly nuked him. He had 120,000 followers, and he'd been nuked for saying that traitors, terrorists who come across the border, southern border, should be shot. Apparently, that's upset whoever is still in there in X. But tell me about your books, Torch, Steve. You'll be here, of course, this next weekend, and then you're going to New York. Have you been to Austin already?
Yeah. We started in Los Angeles. They do kind of the patrician event for buyers of this book who want to have dinner with me and with a few dozen people. And then they do more of a lecture hall for buyers of what I call the plebeian edition, very nice paperback edition. So in Austin, we had a really good turnout of probably 150 or more people for the lecture hall event, and tons of people lined up to ask questions. Basically, could have gone on all night. Austin's very impressive. It's full of people who read books, bright people who are, even though it's on the whole liberal town, it's also people can feel more comfortable there, that they're not going to get canceled and so forth if you have heterodox opinions and feel like coming out in public. I'm off to a private event in Miami for a few dozen people. I think the publisher seemed to have wanted to pick kind of alternatives to where the tech bros are going to, away from Silicon Valley, like Austin and Miami. Got a bunch of rich guys who bought my hardcover and want to pay a lot of money to have dinner with me in Miami. And then we're up to New York City, where everything is sold out, and probably going to be doing some podcasts there and so forth. And there's a lot of excitement in New York City, apparently. I'm told that I'm big in New York. I'm big in a certain part of lower Manhattan at this point, for reasons that I don't really understand after all these decades. But the cool young people on lower Manhattan are starting to get into Steve Saylor. So
I mean, this is entirely a catacomb phenomenon. I mean, as far as I can see, you've not had any mainstream media reviews yet, have you? You have a number of distant right publications have been writing about you. But
yes, I mean, soon there'll be Charles Murray's review and the Claremont Review of Books. I've had reviews in quality conservative highbrow publications like that. Whether I'll ever get any reviews in the mainstream media, who knows? This is just one of these weird things that the idea that I became Mr. Unmentionable, the Lord Voldemort of conservative thought in the 21st century, strikes me, as pretty comic. It's not so comic from a net worth over the years, but it is.
And I think I've said to you before, Steve, that Warhol said that Andy Warhol said that eventually everybody will have their 15 minutes of fame. But after the 2016 election, you didn't even get 1.5 seconds of fame, did you? There were two articles in the mainstream media saying, oh, look at this, this fellow predicted Trump's election strategy and his victory. But after that, you've had absolutely no mainstream media engagement, have you, for the last 4 years?
Tucker McDougall in New York Magazine. I think I was interviewed by Dave Weigel in the Washington Post. Those are good guys. But, I mean, it's partly, you know, those type of open-minded journalists are getting squeezed out of, the establishment press and so forth. It would cause psychic damage, apparently, to the staffs of most of the major publications to these days to mention my name.
It's very odd if you think about that. You would have expected that the advent of the internet would have made the mainstream media more honest, because they were facing contradiction and criticism for saying things that were not true. But in fact, that's completely wrong. It's that they simply doubled down.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened was that the New York Times went through a lot of hard times in 2008. Then they got bailed out by Carlos Slim, the Mexican media monopolist. It was pretty cheap for Slim, who was at Times the richest man in the world with around $100 billion that he'd extracted from the poor and the lower middle class of Latin America by charging them an enormous amount for their telephones. And he's like, oh, well, if I loan $200 million to keep the New York Times from going broke, then they won't write bad articles about my robber baron ways toward the poor people of Mexico. And then they'll probably feel like, you know, writing more about how America needs more illegal aliens, because I really make a fortune when illegal aliens place phone calls back to their loved ones.
And the irony here, of course, is that he's not actually Mexican at all, is he? I mean, he's a market dominant minority. He's Lebanese.
Carlos Slim, I think after World War II, he married, he's a Lebanese Maronite, I believe. He married into the leading far right wing quasi-fascist political dynasty of warlords in Lebanon, the Jamaals, who more or less started the Lebanese Civil War of 1975 to 1990. Carlos Slim's cousin-in-law, Bashir Jamal, when the Israelis invaded, they ordered Lebanon to make Bashir Jamal the president, but then he got blown up by some other warlord, some other Christian warlord, in probably the most dramatic moment of the whole 15-year-long civil war, which point his supporters decided they'd take it out on the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, and the Israeli army pretty much opened the gates to the refugee camps, and thousands were massacred. Back in the good old days, the New York Times, their obituary for Carlos Slim's cousin-in-law, Bashir Jamal, the headline was, Bashir Jamal, he lived by the sword. But never mentioned that their financial savior, you know, is married to Bashir's cousin and is closely related to the whole Falange or fascist party of Lebanon.
Steve, I really ought to let you go and start on your rather unusual routine. You seem to work very late at night, is that right?
Yeah, that's
so. We got you up early this morning. I mean, it's only 3 o'clock for you, isn't it?
I was set my alarm for 1:08 p.m.
So. Tell us what you're going to say next weekend at the VDAR conference.
Well, I'm probably going to talk for maybe about 35 minutes and then take a lot of questions. I'll probably read two pieces. One's an upcoming article in Chronicles magazine that's a summary of one of the most really unexpected trends of the decade of the Great Awakening, or I kind of expected it, but it's probably the least noticed in public, which is how common and how respectable has it become to go in the mainstream media and prestige institutions and just spout off racist hatred for an entire racial group, namely white Americans. And the amount of racist hate that we, you know, that we read in the New York Times every week, 20 years ago would have been like, oh, you can't, you're not supposed to say that. That's just, you know, vicious, racist animus. But no, it's just encouraged all the time. And so I'm going to talk about that and try to assess just how bad that is. The other thing I'm going to talk about is kind of a new piece that I wrote semi-new for the closing of my book from a couple articles I published years earlier called "What If I'm Right?" You know, I've been basically banned from national discussion on the grounds that, well, Saylor, he seems to always win these arguments he gets into, but if everybody believed him, if more people believed him, that would be like absolutely catastrophic. So we just got to keep him quiet. What if I'm right? Is that going to be the end of the world? A lot of people seem to think so. A lot of people seem to think that if I'm right, then we should end the world and just blow up everything. And I want to say, no, you're crazy. The world can carry on. In fact, it'd probably be a little bit better if everybody started listening to me a little bit. Because I believe that the truth is better for us than ignorance, lies, and wishful thinking. At minimum, it's a lot more interesting.
Thanks so much, Steve. We really look forward to seeing you. Ladies and gentlemen, you can. We are sold out because there's tremendous pent-up demand for conferences on the distant right. But you can live stream. You can buy a live stream ticket for $100, I believe. And the you can get to it by vdare/donate, etc. And if you can't figure out how to do it, just email Lydia at lbrimlow@vdare.com and she'll tell you. Steve, thanks very much. We really look forward to seeing you.
Thanks so much.
Bye now.
See you in West Virginia.